Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Stack Trace. It's the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And yes, I still do remember that tagline. I think I got it right. Right, Rambo?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it's been a while since we recorded. I actually had to look it up now before we went live, so to speak. And it seems like, well, it was almost 2 years since we published the last episode, which, yeah, time really flies, right?
Well, you know how it goes. Let's pause the podcast for a couple of months while we get things sorted out in our lives and professional work and stuff like that. And then almost 2 years fly by.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so typical. It's like, it's sometimes really hard to keep track of time. And especially when it's something that you don't do it like regularly. Like back when we used to do like weekly episodes or episodes every 2 weeks or something, we had like a set day where we were always recording. You know, it was like it was happening kind of automatically. But once you kind of break that and then you want to go back to it, you can kind of just lose track of it after a little while.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's really great to be back. It's not because we didn't want to record the podcast or anything that we stopped. It's more like you said, we were busy, you know, with work stuff, family stuff, life stuff, you know, everything. But we got this feeling like we've been having this feeling actually for a while that we want to bring the show back. And, you know, we talk all the time still on iMessage and we share ideas and you share project progress with each other and so on. And so it's not that we haven't been keeping in touch or anything, but we've been having this feeling that we do want to bring the podcast back because we've always loved to record Stack Trace. But then again, it was just that thing where, oh, maybe next month, we'll see. And then, you know, time goes by. But then I think both of us, we've been attending some conferences during the last 2 years. And it feels like anytime I go to a conference, like the number one question I get from people is, when is Stack Trace coming back? Or when am I going to do podcasts again in general? But a lot of people have been asking me about Stack Trace. So that was another kind of little incentive, if you will, or like a little push to actually bring the show back. So to anyone who's been asking about the show, either on like online or when meeting me at conferences and so on, like you're the reason primarily we're bringing the show back because, well, we got that extra little push to finally do it.
Yeah, I especially want to thank the person who came up to me at TriSwift Tokyo just to say how grateful they were for Stack Trace and that they actually learned English in great part by listening to Stack Trace.
Wow.
So that made me very proud of of our work here. And can English be considered your first language or not?
No, Swedish is my first language. But of course, I speak a lot of English these days as well because I don't live in Sweden. I live in Poland. And a lot of people here I speak English with. I, of course, also speak a lot of Polish and Swedish sometimes and so on. It's a big mix over here. So I guess like English, I would say, is probably my like first language that I'm using day to day right now. But I still consider, you know, Swedish is my native language. But I am always working on my English and trying to make it as good as I possibly can.
Same. So I guess that helps for people who are learning. We use simpler words and talk more slowly sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. When we don't get too excited about the technology, right? And then, you know, things can go quickly.
Exactly.
It's worth also mentioning that our plan for the podcast. So what we're going to do now for like the foreseeable future, and we don't know for how long it will last, but our plan at least is to keep doing this podcast once a month and to release new episodes every month. So it will probably be around this time every month that we'll do an episode and we might miss a week or two here or something if there's anything specific going on, like WWDC or some big event that's happening. But that's our plan for now. So hopefully you'll stay subscribed in your podcast player of choice and new episodes will be available every month.
Yeah. And if you are happy about us coming back, please let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. So for this kind of new version of Stack Trace, I don't know which iteration we're up to now. Is it 2.0, 3.0, whatever it might be, the 2026 edition of Stack Trace, let's just say. We thought that it would be fun to do a format where for each episode, we each pick a topic and then we talk about it. So it's going to be a very kind of loose format, not so many, you know, specific chapters or specific smaller topics. we're going to probably not talk that much about news per se. Of course, we might like talk about something that is relevant right now. I mean, hopefully we will. but not so much about like what's Apple going to release next month or something like that, but more like focused on programming topics in general, technology topics in general, things that we're interested in about right now. And yeah, kind of take it from there. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Sounds good.
All right. So for this one, this episode, let's start with your topic, Rambo. So what do you have for us today?
So I would like to talk to you about agentic coding.
All right. How could we pick anything else than AI as our first topic coming back, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry for those who are tired of listening about this stuff. I know it can be annoying because we know, like, there's always people who are maybe too excited about the technology, as you mentioned before. So, yeah, sometimes it feels like, oh, everywhere I look, it's just AI, AI, AI. But I promise we'll try to talk about the actual practical use that I've been making. And I'm sure John is also going to mention some of the stuff he's been working on. But I don't know about you, John, but I've been using agentic coding more and more, and it happened quite quickly. The switch from, oh, I just use ChatGPT every now and then to ask a coding question or help implement an algorithm or something like that, to, oh, I'm just letting the thing run and do everything by itself.
Yeah, I would say I'm not quite there yet. At least it depends a bit on the project. Some projects I work on, which are mostly kind of experimental or like research projects, I use a lot of agentic coding. But I would say like for my freelance work and kind of the professional work that I do, I still like to be the one kind of in the driver's seat. And I utilize AI a lot. And sometimes I can spin up like an agentic session to go off and do a pull request or a code review or something like that, or ask it to improve or refactor something. But I would say it varies a lot for me depending on the project. And it hasn't been one of those kind of like I adopted ChatGPT or AI for questions, and then I immediately kind of moved over to agentic coding. It's been more like a back and forth for me.
Right. Yeah. I still use the usual questions and answers format, but I feel like agentic coding has lots of good uses already, especially within like the past 3 or 4 weeks, maybe, where lots and lots of tools and new models have been released. And my favorite tool so far has been OpenAI's Codex, and specifically the app, not the command line interface. I mean, I'm not against command line interfaces, but I feel like if you want to really do a lot of work, and that's probably just a me thing, like I know people who live in a terminal and they use Vim or Emacs and Tmux and all of that good stuff, but I'm just a GUI person. Like my name starts with GUI, so it makes sense. So yeah, I prefer to use the Codex GUI, and it works quite well. But like you mentioned, you have to kind of know how to use it and also choose where you want to apply it. And you can't really apply it willy-nilly to any project in any way. I mean, it's fine if you just want to try something out, but especially if you want to bring it into an existing code base, and especially if it's a large code base, you do have to be careful with how you use it. And not to mention, of course, which it is the elephant in the room, and I think everyone who's listening to this knows about it, but like there's all the licensing issues, and of course the fact that your code is being uploaded somewhere and you don't really know what's happening with that code. So especially if you're working for someone else, like in your case when you're doing freelancing, yeah, then you definitely can't just open up your client's project in Codex and let it rip.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it depends a lot on the project, and it also depends a lot on the client, like what they want me to do, right? Or like what kind of how much they want to share their code with all these systems. But either way, I can always use like agent sessions kind of in isolation. So what I can do sometimes is I can actually take some code, pull it out of the project so that it's not like, or if it's some code that I'm working on or something that doesn't have any kind of business secrets or anything for that particular client or that particular project, and then like put it in a separate repository and iterate on it with AI agents. And then when it's done, or like when I'm ready to like integrate it back into the project, then I simply just take that code and bring it back, right? Mm-hmm. So creating kind of like a little sandbox environment for my agent to work on. And that's, in general, I would say how I prefer currently. This changes very rapidly over time, I will say. Like, you know, right. A few years ago, none of us had even heard about AI agents, right? And now many people are using them. But I do, as of today, I like to kind of create more sandbox environments for my agents to work in. Like, I'm not the person who would install, you know, Claude Code or Codex or something, like, and just let it run on my machine, you know, unchecked and just do whatever it wants. But rather, I use actually a lot of the AI tools that I use them through GitHub and through the GitHub Copilot. I have like a Copilot Pro subscription, and that lets me also pick between different models and try different things for different outcomes. And that's where I like to like create a separate repository, ask the agent, whichever agent I'm using at the time, through Copilot to actually like, you know, do the task that I wanted to do. And that also, at least it makes me feel that I'm more kind of in control and I can review the outcome easier rather than if it would iterate more, as you say, like running loose.
Right. Yeah, I also have access to Copilot, and I don't know why, but they are subsidizing my subscription for some reason. I don't know why. If anyone is listening and you're responsible for me getting a freebie from GitHub, thank you, I guess. But yeah, every month they say, oh, we're renewing your access for free. And I don't really understand why. There's probably a link in that email that I should read, but I didn't. So, but it's good that you mentioned it, because I'm also using agentic support in Visual Studio Code, which is using Copilot behind the scenes. And yes, you can select from many different models. I was getting really excited about Google's Gemini Pro for Swift coding specifically, because I had done some testing using like the normal web UI for it, and it did some things in Swift that I didn't see ChatGPT or Claude Code doing, like in terms of code quality and also like the style matching more of like the code style that I like to see. But they recently shipped, I think it was the 3.1 Pro Gemini model, and their infrastructure is just completely broken. Like it never never quite works very well. So I paused that until they figure out their infrastructure situation. But one of the places where I feel like most developers could take advantage of these tools is if you have a need to program in an environment or a language that you're not very familiar with. Of course, that also has its drawbacks, where maybe if you're not very familiar with it, you are not going to be able to review what the agent did as well. But if you know a little bit or enough to be dangerous, I would say having an agent help you with that work is really good. And the first thing I would suggest people try agents for, if you haven't yet, is take a node project you have lying around and ask an agent to modernize it. And this can be any type of project, like it can be an Xcode project, it can be a Swift package, or in my case, I have a bunch of little backend things, most of them using the Cloudflare Workers runtime. And some of them are quite old, and they were using a very old way of doing Cloudflare Workers. So I had recently I don't remember. I think it was Codex that I used in Visual Studio Code through Copilot, and they have the agentic mode there. So I asked it to, hey, this is a Cloudflare worker, and it's using deprecated stuff, old stuff, and it's not using the ES module syntax. Can you please modernize this for me and use node version, whatever? So I specified everything, and like in a few minutes, it completely revamped the project, and now it's in a much better shape than it was before. And of course, I checked everything and everything looked correct. I tested everything. Everything still worked correctly. And many of these backends that I was kind of not wanting to touch because of how old they were and clunky, you would run Cloudflare commands to deploy them and get a bunch of warnings. Hey, this is deprecated. This don't do this anymore and stuff like that. I was able to modernize those. And those were chores that if I were to make and get to not really rewrite because like the actual logic is still the same, but all of the structure around it changes. If I were to do it by myself, I wouldn't do it because it's like it's such a chore and it would take hours probably. So if you have old legacy projects and you want to modernize them to a newer runtime, language, OS or whatever, I would start there with agents.
Yeah, that's a very, very good tip. I also love it for these kinds of tasks that are like kind of like chores. You know, they're not really this fun problem solving kind of programming, which I think many programmers, like that's the reason why we love programming, is because we like to build things and solve problems and figure it out and, you know, see the UI come to life or see the logic, you know, come together and it all works. Like that's the fun part, right? Yeah. But actually like modernizing your code base to support a newer framework or something, or like upgrading your dependencies or solving linking issues. Like that's another thing I love using AI for, is like, oh, I have the C++ linking error because I upgraded my dependency. Can you solve it for me? And it's just, it's kind of shocking how quick they can solve things like this compared to if you need to like dig into the build logs yourself, figure it out. And with API upgrades, you have to like read the documentation, figure out what the new version is. You know, maybe there's not an equivalent. You have to figure out how you're supposed to migrate that and so on. That can take quite a lot of time. And of course, anytime you use any kind of AI, I would say there's also always the trade-off of sometimes it can be faster, or many times it can be faster, but you also maybe don't learn as much during the process. And also you hinted at it earlier, Rambo, as well. Sometimes, you know, it can be difficult sometimes to understand the changes that were made, especially if you're not super familiar with that environment. And that can also be a pretty big downside, right? So it's like with a lot of things in programming, is a trade-off between speed versus knowledge versus like how well can you actually verify and check this. It's kind of interesting where, you know, in AI, they can be right like 8 times out of 10 or something, like write a really good implementation, but they will never tell you when they are not sure, right? It will always present as the same confident answers. And it's that kind of danger there where those 20% that you need to catch where it was actually wrong, you can't let your guard down, right? Yeah, you need to make sure that you're still verifying everything. And that can kind of be the challenge, I would say, compared to writing it manually, where you can, of course, also make a lot of mistakes, but usually you are at least aware a little bit more of your own limitations and when you're sure of something versus not. Of course, you can sometimes have false confidence. It's a complex topic, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, just to say that I do also really like it for these kinds of chores where I am happy to accept the trade-off of, okay, I'm not fully gonna, you know now how to upgrade from this version of Node to this version of Node because I didn't do it manually, so I maybe won't remember much of it, but it will get done, right? Yeah. So that's kind of the trade-off you make there.
Yeah, and also in my case, like I could have done that migration myself, but imagine how much time it would take just reading documentation. And I don't know about you, but I don't really learn a lot when I'm reading like the Cloudflare documentation on how to upgrade a worker from version X to version Y. It's information that kind of I read it, I do what I have to do, and it goes away. Because it's not...
It goes like in through the eyes and out through the fingers when you're typing the code.
Exactly. So I wouldn't really be learning a lot. And the things I have to do to fix that or upgrade in this case, I already know how to do them. But that's also a problem, because we're talking about senior developers in this case, you and I. But if you are not a senior developer and you're just learning, that's a problem. And I know you are going to talk more about that, but let's continue on the topic for now. So something else I really like to do with agents these days, and it kind of goes to what you said about isolating creating like a sandbox for a project. Sometimes I need something very specific. Say I'm working on something in AirBuddy, for example, and I need a specific algorithm or structure or UI component. Although UI components, I still like to write myself. But just for the sake of example, I can go to Xcode, and you don't have to do this, but I like to do this. I go to Xcode, I create a new Swift package, I configure the OS versions and basic boilerplate of the Swift package. I close the Swift package in Xcode, then I open the project in Codex, and then I say, hey, this is a Swift package that has to support this and this OS version. It has to have this and this functionality. Do it. And more often than not, it will do a pretty good job. And you also, you can kind of control the level of control that you want to have over it. Because if you just create an empty Swift package and just tell it, this Swift package should do X, it's going to do it, but it's going to do it in a certain way.
Yeah.
That, who knows, like it's going, it's also... LLMs are random by design, so it's going to come up with a solution for you. Actually, before that, you could even start out with a completely empty directory and say, write a Swift package, and it will create the package.swift and all the structure. It will even, a friend of mine had the audacity of creating an empty folder and asking it to create a Mac app, and it wrote the Xcode proj by hand and actually implemented a full-fledged Mac app that works. So that was pretty... Of course, they already had Xcode installed, otherwise that wouldn't work. But yeah, I used the Xcode build behind the scenes and things like that. Then you can create a basic structure. Something else I like to do, if I want control... Say I'm writing a Swift package and I want control over the API... Sometimes I will actually write the API. I will define the types that I want and the functions, properties, access controls, actor isolation. I will basically write a Swift interface for my package, but without the implementation.
Right.
And then tell the agent to go ahead and implement it. And that gives me more control, because now I have grounded the work on the public API interface that I want, and that will inform what the agent's going to do. Of course, it's absolutely not the same as you doing it, because if I were to do it, I would then maybe have another idea while I'm writing the implementation. I would think, oh, actually, this API will not work so well with this implementation, so let me change the API a little bit. So there are trade-offs there. Another thing, you can write the API interfaces. You can write the API interfaces and documentation for them. And that gives the model even more stuff to work with. Or you can just write the documentation and not write the API interfaces. So there are different levels of control you can have based on the amount of input you give to the model.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it all comes down to like, what are your goals for what you're trying to do, right?
Yeah.
Are you building something for yourself, like a little utility? Then you can let the agent do the whole thing, right? Because it's just a utility for yourself. And it doesn't really matter what the implementation is, as long as, you know, it doesn't, you know, delete all your files or something like that, something terrible. As long as it actually does what you want it to do. And this is where the review comes in. But the quality of the actual code or the structure of it and so on is less relevant in that context, right?
Yeah.
Again, if you're not trying to use it for learning or something like that, even though AIs can be incredibly useful for that too, but that's beside the point. If you just want to have like a utility for yourself, you can just generate it and there you go. If it can get the job done. But if you are working like in a team in a more professional context and you're building this feature that's going to integrate with the rest of the project, then you might want to take like a slightly different approach, right? And not just generate the whole thing. And I think really what it comes down to is really this review process, especially if you're using it in an actual project, right? Like if you're integrating it into a long-running project, if you're working with a team, if you're doing it for a client, any kind of professional context, I think it's fine to use agents in those contexts too. Again, it depends a lot on on what you're allowed to do, of course, and how you can share the code and so on. That's always a challenge for me. But I can definitely use them in that context, but it really comes down to the review in that case. Like I'm less than of a person typing out all of the code, and I'm more kind of the project manager for that feature, right? And mm-hmm. I ensure that the code quality is good enough, and I go in and make manual edits where needed. I review and make sure everything is good. I don't just like generate it and open up the pull request, right? Like that's where I see sometimes in the current state of AI where it can go wrong, and this is where we enter this kind of AI slop territory, right? Where it's like, you know, you generate something and you just immediately like push it to production, right? And again, it, like there are situations where that's acceptable if you're doing it for your own, because you need it yourself and you just wanted to have some fun. But if you're in a more kind of professional context, then it's usually a good idea to like really thoroughly review the code, go in and make those manual edits and ensure that it's like really up to standard, and also guide the agent as well. Like it's not always the case of, oh, the human knows best and, you know, you have to, you know, fix all the mistakes. But sometimes the AI just needs more guidance. Like you said, mm-hmm. like sometimes writing the documentation is a great idea because then it has more context to work with. I also really like to usually set up like markdown documents in my various projects that like for the agents and really describe things in detail. And sometimes I use AI for that too, where I'm like, you know, oh, I want to build this kind of project. Can you generate a good agentic description for it? And then again, I review the description, I put it in the repository, and then the agents can use that. I also really like to create like specific prompts for specific agents, where I say something like, you know, you're a very skeptical code reviewer. You really want to make sure that no bugs make it to production. You scrutinize every little detail. You're very concerned about code quality and code standards. And I write this, and then I use that prompt when I ask the agent or the AI for a code review. And then that gives me sometimes a better result because, the AI has better direction to go with. It knows what I want from it instead of just asking for a review without any kind of specific instructions.
I will say that from what I heard from people who are more experienced with AI agents is that the more recent models, for the more recent models, that sort of prompt doesn't make that big of a difference as it used to. What it will often do is make it kind of have like a quote-unquote personality.
Right. Which I also
whatever
like.
You say. Yeah, it's also fun. Like you can have fun with that. You can tell it to be snarky or something if you want like a carrot weather style code reviewer.
Exactly.
But you can definitely have fun with that. I kind of laugh now when I remember the term prompt engineering. Remember that? Because that was super important a while back. And these days, it's still useful, of course. But these days, prompt engineering is just typing. It's just speaking. It doesn't have to be a super careful, thought-out thing. But yeah, when you're talking about coding, I think if you want to have something that will be to your quality standards, you will have to give a lot of guidance still. Yeah. Maybe this will change maybe before this episode is out, this will change. But for now, you still have to be more specific. And that brings us to the conclusion that I think most developers who have been using this for a while have come to, which is, it's just another level of abstraction. That's it.
Yeah, it's another tool in the toolbox, really.
Exactly. So when I am doing something more carefully, because I plan on integrating it into production software, the level of problem solving and thinking about architecture and things like that that I do hasn't really changed much. What's changed is that sometimes I have a better rubber duck, basically, which I can talk to the model and it can suggest architecture options and things like that. But ultimately, I am deciding what I want to have in terms of architecture and quality. And if I don't like what it's doing, I will absolutely trash it and say, hey, this is not good. And also, over time, you get used to the pitfalls with the different coding agents. And I've been mostly using Codex. And so I kind of know what it tends to do sometimes that I don't like. So I add that to my agents.md file so that, hey, please don't do this. Like, for example, any Swift UI code, coding agents still love to use Combine. And I have nothing against Combine, but we have better abstractions now with the observable macro and things like that. So I have it in my agents.md. Basically, like, Combine is forbidden. Never use Combine. And also little snippets of API documentation for things like automatic observation in AppKit and UIKit with the observable macro, which wasn't a thing when these models were last trained. So they don't know that. So you kind of have to teach them. Default actor isolation, for example, is another thing that most AI agents don't know about. So if you have a project that has main actor as the default isolation, some models will get extremely confused. So I have a little snippet of documentation as well for my Swift projects about that. So it's another level of abstraction, and it basically reduces the amount of typing that I have to do, but not that much the amount of thinking, really.
Yeah, I think that's really key there. Like, that you still want to think, right? And still solve those problems. And you mentioned something that I think is really important earlier, which is when you have the agent just implement the implementation for you, you don't get that second, third, fourth time of thinking about the problem that might change your mind or might made you realize something, right? Yep. Which so many times, like, if I do the same where I write like an interface and then I start writing the implementation by hand, I will go back and change the interface several times because I realize, this is actually not the right abstraction for this problem, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't get that same kind of iterations when you're working with an agent because, well, it's the agent iterating, right?
Yeah.
And one way that I've been trying to kind of mitigate that, because again, I want to use these tools. Like, I think it's really important as a developer that you can have different opinions about AI. I certainly have very mixed opinions about AI when it comes to like how it will influence society in general, right? And
same.
You mentioned like the elephant in the room earlier in this episode. It's a very, very complex topic, right? So yeah. I don't want to come across as like, you know, everyone should use AI. It's amazing. That's definitely not my opinion. But I do always want to keep an open mind about it. It's the same like when Swift came out, right? I was doing Objective-C primarily back then, but I saw Swift as this new opportunity to write better apps and to learn new language and, you know, develop as a developer. And I jumped on that, and I've done the same thing, you know, throughout the last 10 years. Like, when there's new technologies coming out, you migrate to them, you learn them. And I feel like this is another example of that. I definitely want to be open-minded and try it out and try to integrate into my workflow as much as I can, but not like go overboard and say like, oh, now I'm not going to write any code anymore. I'm just going to use the agent, right? Like, I feel like the truth is usually somewhere in the middle, right? That that's where you find the best balance. And for me, like a trick that I've been using a lot is really to break down problems a lot before I ask the agent to work on it. I've noticed that if I ask it to build something that is too complex, like if I write a spec for a feature and I ask it to open a pull request implementing that feature, and it's too big in the scope, it's kind of the same for a human, right? Like, if the scope is too big, it's hard to keep track of it. And you get that same problem with an agent. So I found that breaking down a problem and really like, you know, having smaller iteration steps, it also makes it so much easier to review the code that is generated as well. So you have that good confidence that what you're actually integrating into your project is good code. For me, at least, I get kind of the best of both worlds when I do it that way. I get the benefits of the speed up of the using agents and using AI as a coding assistant. But I'm still kind of, like I mentioned earlier in the episode, I'm still in the driver's seat. I am still the one who is like running the actual project. And I feel like that kind of strikes a nice balance for me personally.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And yeah, I think the major limitation as of right now with these AI coding agents is the infamous context window.
Right.
If you reach a point where it can't reason about the project or the code base in general within the limits of its context window, you're cooked, basically. Like, there is... And when vibe coding became like a thing, you would see a lot of people posting on like Reddit and things like that, complaining about, oh, I've been working on this project for a few months now, and now we can't do anything anymore because it's too big. So it is a problem. And to some extent, humans have the same problem. We can't hold an entire code base at the same time in our brain if it's a big code base. But what I I'm not a neuroscientist or anything like that, but from what I understand, as soon as you start going through, let's say you have to do something, change something in a part of the code base you haven't touched in a really long time, as soon as you start reading that part of the code base, your neurons start to reconnect, basically, and reconstruct that memory from when you initially wrote that, to some extent, of course, and with errors as well. We're not perfect, but the AI doesn't really do that. It kind of has to reread everything. Just yesterday, I was doing something with Codex, and it reached the context window limit right as it was finishing up something that it was working on, and I saw the compacting context window message, and right afterwards it basically went, oh, let me read the entire code base again. So and then like 2/3 of the context window were pre-filled, basically, because it was kind of working on something pretty hard by the time it reached the limit. So that is the biggest limit. I would think that most AI companies out there are probably working really hard on trying to increase the context window size.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they will use all this RAM that they're buying for for something, right? Like, that situation is also really crazy, and also gives me even more mixed feelings about this whole AI, you know? But yeah, topic for another day, I guess. But yeah, I agree. That's why I mentioned earlier that I like to really try to break down the problems as much as possible, because otherwise you do hit those context limits quite quickly, especially if it's something that, you know, requires a lot of background explanation and these sorts of things that just take up memory, right? So yeah, I totally agree with that.
So we mentioned learning, and I know you want to talk some more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny when, you know, when I go and I meet people at conferences and so on, and, you know, people who know me from like my website. And so I think a lot of people associate me with Swift, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. I mean, I made my website Swift by Sundell. So I literally put my name and Swift together. So that's like, you know, that association is by my own doing, right?
Yep.
But people sometimes get surprised when they hear that I am not just doing Swift development. That is not just, you know, I only like Swift, and that's the only language I care about. Because you know this, Rambo, because you've known me for a long time. Like, you know that I'm actually really a programming language nerd, right? Like, mm-hmm. I really love programming languages, and I really like to learn new ones, and I like to explore when there's new ones coming out. I love the programming languages subreddit on Reddit, like where people post like their own compilers that they're doing and so on. Like, it's a lot of fun to follow that along. And I am also always very fascinated by programming language design and different trade-offs that are made there. Like, you know, do you optimize for memory safety or for speed or for the syntax or for the tooling? Like, what's the priority, right? Because like with many things in life, you can't have it all, right? Like, you have to choose your battles. So AI, sticking with the AI topic, right? Like, that's what we have to do here on this first episode back in 2026, has been a great tool for me as I've been exploring new languages and learning more things about languages I've wanted to get better at. So one of those languages that I've been using quite a lot for the last few years is Rust, where Rust for me is a very interesting kind of cousin to Swift in a way. Right. Where it was created around the same time. It's trying to solve similar problems when it comes to, you know, building a modern language that is fast, that has good memory safety, that has good defaults, that feels good to write, has like things like generics and all those kinds of good stuff. But it's at the same time takes a very different approach than Swift in some key areas, especially when it comes to like the syntax itself, and when it comes to kind of the model of how values are being passed around, how you call functions and so on. It's quite different there. So during the last few years, as I've wanted to get better and better at Rust to kind of move it up in my skill level to be like similar to my Swift skill level, AI has been incredibly useful for that. Where one thing that I really like to do as I am working with Rust is that if I encounter something where I know how I would write that in Swift in like a really clean way, but I'm not quite sure how I would do it in Rust, I will actually just open up like, you know, ChatGPT or GitHub or whichever AI I'm using at that moment and just say like, hey, how would you write this in Rust? And I would then just write the Swift code.
Right.
And that's been incredible for just like learning not just like the syntax or the language features, but the idioms that people use and the kind of the standards that exist in the community. And of course, like with everything AI, like we mentioned, we have to review it, take it with a grain of salt always and so on. But, you know, if you look at the references, if you then like look that up, if it suggests you to use some kind of pattern that you're not familiar with, it's incredibly useful for that. So I've been using AI a lot recently to like explore different programming languages, not just Rust. Like I've been doing a lot of different languages and it's been really, really cool for that. And I think for anyone who wants to kind of branch out and learn like a new language or just try something different, like it's a great time to do that, I think.
Yeah, I definitely used it for the same purpose as well. I'm not learning Rust. I played around with it a little bit, but I have no real use for it in my work. So, and I'm not a language nerd, so learning a language by itself is not a really big incentive for me. But I have used models to convert from one language into another, like a classic one. And I'm not suggesting you rewrite working code for the sake of rewriting, but I've had situations where I had like an old Objective-C class in one of my code bases, and it's one of those where, oh, it's been around for several years and it does what it does and it works and there's nothing wrong with it, but, oh, now I need to change something. And then you start to notice that, oh, there's a bunch of bridging codes because this is Objective-C and you need something from Swift or vice versa. So in cases like that, I will sometimes grab the Objective-C code and tell an AI, hey, can you please rewrite this in Swift, modern Swift with concurrency or whatever? And it usually does a really good job. And also converting, going back to my backend example, some backends that I had originally written in plain JavaScript, I have had an AI convert to TypeScript, which is way better. I still don't really like it, but it's way better than JavaScript, and it does the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, for me, the reason I like so much to explore programming languages and to learn new ones, even if it's not for work, like I've been learning languages like Zig and Odin lately, like I'm not planning on using them for any kind of production work, but it's just really fun to, again, explore like different ideas in different languages and how they solve problems and how they also sometimes say, we're not going to do X, Y, or Z, right? Like how they decide not to include a specific feature. And I feel like anytime I do that kind of exploration, anytime I learn something new and try to build something with a new language I'm not familiar with, It ticks off a lot of ideas in my brain, right? Like I get a lot of new inspiration, and it's not just for, you know, language features, but it could be like, oh, this is an interesting pattern that I haven't been using much before. I wonder how that could work in Swift, right? Yeah. And then you could bring it back and maybe implement something similar or be inspired by it. And that's something I've been doing for forever, like since I started learning to program, is that I really to try to be inspired not just by the current domain that I'm in, because it can limit your thinking. I feel like if you're just focusing on like iOS development with Swift, for example, you can of course be a really good iOS developer and get the job done. But where you can really, I feel like, find the creative, interesting solutions is when you kind of branch out a bit and look at the programming world at large, because it's so rich, right? There's so many things to learn from and be inspired by, and it can really kind of just like get those ideas flowing, I feel like.
Yeah, one place where I really like to do that is with microcontrollers and hardware stuff, where you are doing mostly C and C++, although there is embedded Swift, but you have to install so much stuff to get embedded Swift to work that I kind of gave up on it. But it does work. And then, of course, it is really nice to be able to use Swift in an embedded device. But yeah, doing that sort of thing, branching out, even if it's just a hobby, is definitely a good idea. And especially, I feel like I really like doing microcontroller stuff every now and then, because it's so different from doing something for an iPhone or a Mac, where you are working on a device with a super powerful CPU, GPU, and a neural engine and a really high resolution display. And then you go to a thing that's just a chip on a board and has like a 50 kilobytes of RAM.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, heap allocations? No, can't use those, right?
Too expensive. Yeah, exactly. So I do see the benefits on doing that. But talking about AI in this context, how do you think, especially if people are newer into development at large, like how would you suggest someone use those tools if they're just starting to learn, for example? Because I honestly have no really good suggestion there.
Yeah, it's hard for us to suggest because we are not in this situation, right? Like we've been programming for so long that for us, it's like we're so far removed from that, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the same principles that we talked about earlier still apply, where one way to do it is like, okay, I want to learn how to build a Mac app, or I want to learn how to build a web server in Rust, or I want to learn how to build something with Node.js or a microcontroller program with C++. Like you could go and you could ask your AI of choice to just do it for you, right? And then like, you know, build me this thing. And again, it depends on what your goals are. If your goals are you just want the thing to exist and you don't really care about the code at all, then great, mission accomplished, right? But if you do care about the code, then and you do want to learn, then that's maybe not the right approach. Because again, taking that incremental steps is probably better. But then the question is, how do you know what the incremental steps even are? Yep. If you are learning a new language, like, you know, how do I even get started? And I think like you can start asking questions before you start generating code. You can ask, for example, what's a modern way to set up a project in Go, right? Yeah. And then you can get an answer, and then you can do some of your own research, and then you can be like, okay, so that's how a Go project works. Okay, so then I can maybe ask the AI to generate me like a project that prints hello world or something like that. And then you can go in and say, okay, what do I want to build here? I want to build this algorithm. If you already know another programming language like we do, then you can do the approach that I mentioned earlier, which is to write it in your current language, like the one you're most familiar with, and ask the AI to convert it for you. Or maybe not just convert it, because I'm not always looking for just like transpiling, right? I'm looking for like what's the idiomatic, like recommended way to express this idea in this new language. Like, for example, let's say, you know, in Swift, we have optionals, right? And you're like, okay, optionals are great. How do I use optionals in Rust? Then you can ask like, oh, how I have this type here with these four optional properties. How would you implement that in Rust? And then you get an answer back and you start learning that. And then you kind of take it piece by piece. And at least for me, like that's, I can start exploring a new language really quickly with that idea. Like I can go from, you know, installing a compiler for a new language on my machine, having the AI to ask questions and set up, to actually having like a simple program running in a short period of time because the feedback loop is so quick, right? You get that information. Again, you don't have to go and search and read lots of documentation and read the whole language specification to understand it. You can kind of take it piece by piece and really like see progress quite quickly, I would say.
Yeah, if you really want to learn, I think you can use AI to get over the bumps along the way, basically. And
yeah.
I think everyone has experienced this where you're trying to learn a new language or a new environment or runtime or whatever, and you get into a roadblock where something's not working and you're not sure if it's your setup or if like you're not understanding something. And if you can get over that by using AI, like maybe you would have learned something if you solved it yourself, but that something is not something you should have to learn sometimes. I get really mad at environments that have really complicated dependency management and things like that, and version mismatches. Like, that's why I really dislike Python. I know it's a great language. I have nothing against it, but the whole thing where versioning and virtual environments and things like that, I feel like that's a failure of the ecosystem, not the language, but that's why I tend to avoid things in Python, which is really hard in the age of AI because everything is Python. So sometimes if you can get help from a model to fix those little issues you find along the way to on your learning path, it can actually help keep you motivated to learn. And that's why, for example, if someone asks me, oh, I want to learn iOS app development, should I learn UIKit or SwiftUI? I always recommend SwiftUI, not because I think you should not write UIKit or SwiftUI is the best thing that ever existed. I actually have a lot of, like, for example, Chibi Studio is still 99% UIKit, but there is a lot more of a learning curve with UIKit. So if you want to learn, I feel like starting with something easier that you can iterate more quickly is going to keep you motivated longer. And then eventually in the future, if you want, you can learn the more complicated way of doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you mentioned earlier there with roadblocks is a very, very good thing with AI to help you solve, because especially if you're learning something for fun, right? Or just like you want to just improve yourself as a programmer. Like, you don't want to just be stuck, like, I'm just doing Swift, just iOS, just Swift UI. Like, you want to branch out a bit more and become like more broad in your knowledge, let's say. Like, if that's your goal, then if you hit those roadblocks with dependencies or compiling things or getting the compiler to work or getting the linker to work, whatever it might be, right? Like, that's really, it can really just take you out of it and be like, nah, I'm not going to learn this today, right?
Yeah.
And the more you can kind of remove those blockers, the better, I would say. And I mentioned earlier that I've been using also AI a lot to solve just like those specific tooling issues. And I have a concrete example, which is kind of funny, where so I wanted to learn SDL3, which is this graphics library, or like it's a kind of a holistic library for like inputs and drawing graphics and so on. Like, it's used in a lot of games to power like the graphics and so on.
Yeah, it's like if you wanted to write a game that can run on not iOS, but like the Mac, Windows, and Linux, you could use SDL3 and it does the whole, basically the GUI part of things.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a game engine, but it's like the step below that, right? Like, you're not getting an editor and all the stuff like you would get with something like Unity or Godot, but you get like the library to do all those things. Yeah. So I wanted to use that. I wanted to use it in Rust, of course, because, you know, I was doing Rust. And I wanted to write the code on my Mac, and then I wanted to compile it to Windows from my Mac and then run it on my Windows gaming PC. Like, that was my goal. So it's a kind of complicated setup, right?
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing is that you can do that. Like, that's an amazing thing about Rust, is that it supports cross-compilation in a really nice way. But then, of course, you know, lo and behold, I run into linking errors when I'm trying to link against like the Windows SDK against this SDL with Rust on my Mac, because my Mac does not have those things, right? And then it's like this whole kind of dependency situation. And I just, you know, I pushed the project to a GitHub repository. I asked Copilot to, hey, can you please solve this issue? It's currently not building for Windows from my Mac. And 10 minutes later, the problem was solved.
Nice.
And, you know, it's one of those things where could I have investigated it myself and figured it out? Of course. Like, I've solved those kinds of linking errors and dependency problems with C and C++ so many times. So, of course, I could have done that. But was this a context when I was just trying to learn STL3? I mean, arguably in a very complex way, I was trying to learn STL3. But that's what I wanted to focus on, right? And I just wanted this nice setup where I wanted to work on my Mac, but I wanted to be able to run it on Windows. And it was just one of those situations where I used AI to remove that blocker. I could focus on what I wanted to focus on, and happy days.
Yeah, another example that happened with me, and it was actually quite similar because I'm pretty sure I used the same library in the end, but I was doing some experiments with shaders, doing like fragment shaders for GPU to create interesting visual effects, basically. And I had this Raspberry Pi with a little OLED display, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could just shove a shader into this thing and it would render full screen, like almost like a screensaver? It would look really nice in this OLED display. But I didn't want to learn all of the things required, all the boilerplate around just placing the output of a shader on screen.
Right, setting up the whole pipeline and everything.
Exactly. So all that program would have to do would be to just place something on screen where a shader output will be displayed. And I would be writing the shader myself. I had already written the shader in Shader Toy, which is this website where you can write shaders.
That's the fun part.
Yeah, exactly. So I asked ChatGPT, and it wasn't even a coding agent. It was just regular ChatGPT. And since I actually wanted to learn a little bit, I asked it, what are the different options if I want to run a program on a Raspberry Pi on Linux? And I told it like the environment, like, oh, it's this version of Raspbian with this desktop environment. What are the options for running a program that just displays the output of a shader, basically? And it explained me all the options, the different ways you can do it. And I think in the end, I picked one where it used the STL library to basically put a full screen surface on the display that renders it. And it gave me like, it even gave me like an option if you don't have a desktop environment, you want to blit things directly to the GPU, you can use this other thing. So that was fun. And I was able to do my shader experiments on the Raspberry Pi without having to learn this very specialized library setup for an environment where I am probably never going to write anything for that specific environment again. It was just a fun thing I wanted to do. So having the AI help with that was really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And key there really is like what you said, that you also asked it for different options and you just didn't just put it to work straight away.
Right.
And this, I feel like, is such a good way to also actually get something out of that experience, right? Like now you know more what the options are and you're again still making the calls, the decisions based on the information. And this I feel like is, you know, you're kind of splitting the AI work up into two separate phases where you have like a research phase first, where you're just like asking questions and kind of trying to build an understanding of what you want to build. And then you can ask it to actually like generate the code, or if you want to write the code yourself or write parts of it. Like, but I feel like having those two separate phases is usually a good idea.
Yeah. And with coding agents, you have most of them, if not all, have the planning mode, which some people say you shouldn't use. Other people say you should absolutely use. I use it sometimes for more complicated things, especially if you are someone who just wants something done. Like if you're like my friend who just wanted a Mac app for themselves, you can ask it to plan it out first, because it will help you break things down into smaller problems, which will probably end up in a better result in the end. Because like you mentioned, if you don't break it up into smaller pieces, the model can and probably will eventually get confused and mess things up. And if you are absolutely not a developer at all, you're going to have a really hard time figuring it out. It has probably happened to you as well. Sometimes the agent will kind of end up in kind of a loop where it does something, it doesn't work, it undoes it, and it doesn't work, and then it does the same thing again. And sometimes I can clearly tell that it had the wrong understanding of what the problem was. Just yesterday, and this was a little experiment, nothing important. So I was actually using the built-in agent support in Xcode, and it got stuck thinking that the asset catalog was missing an asset. Like there was an image in the asset catalog and it thought the image was not there. And it took me a long time to find out that it ended up in that state because I just left it running in the background and continued my work in something else. And I only noticed it after probably like 30 minutes when there was a little pop-up and then the Xcode icon bounced because it was trying to run a terminal command. And pro tip, if you're using coding agents in Xcode, like the Xcode integration, and they try to run terminal commands, it's because they screwed up. it will rarely want to run a terminal command because they have all of the MCP tools inside of Xcode to do everything that they should have to do, basically.
Right.
So if they want to do something that Xcode can't do, they probably messed up. So he had spent probably the past like 10 minutes on this missing asset that he thought was missing, but it was actually there. I have no idea why. Maybe they can't read asset catalogs or something. If you are a developer, keep an eye out for that. And if you're not a developer, good luck.
But this is an interesting time we live in, I think. Like with these tools, and you know, we mentioned it earlier that the development is going so quickly. Like it feels like if we would do the same episode like we're doing today, but in 6 months, we would have completely different takes on everything. Yeah. You know, it's a very complex topic, but at the same time, like I personally remain just as excited about tech and about programming and stuff as I've been, you know, 10 years ago. And it's just like the shape is shifting, right? Like we're doing it in a different way. We are using these new tools. We're trying to figure out how to be productive with them and so on. But yeah, the number one constant is change, right? Like always. Yeah. But it's fun. That's also why it's fun being back doing this podcast now, because, you know, it's fun to talk about and to think about. And, you know, there are so many ideas always of how we can utilize these technologies. So yeah, I'm keeping to be an optimist about all of this stuff.
Yeah, same. And just a word of advice for those who are not developers and are using these tools to make little things for themselves. Make little things for yourself. Don't ask the AI to write like a software as a service business backend for you, because I mean, we've seen, and I think a lot of what people think about and developers love to hate on this stuff is because the stories that come out are from like the, oh, this person wrote this stock exchange backend using an AI engine and they lost everything. So that's what you see in the news. But some people just want like, oh, I want a clone of Winamp for my Mac or something. And you're the only one who's going to use it. Or if you share that with other people, it's just something running locally on your Mac. So the risk there is very minimal. So I would say, stick to those types of projects until you have the knowledge to actually understand what's going on.
Yeah, I think if it's something we can say to kind of summarize this episode is that, you know, the tools change, right? Like now we have more tools, we have this AI agents and tools at our disposal, but the principles remain the same, right?
Yep.
Like attacking any kind of software project involves breaking it down, like thinking about the problems, coming up with solutions, doing research, experimenting, testing. You know, those things are still the same, even though the tools are constantly evolving and changing. So I think for anyone kind of who wants to get started, it's about learning that methodology, right? Like learning those principles. And that's the best way, I think, to do that, regardless if you're, you know, learning a new language or just programming for the first time or building something new. It's just to kind of, you know, take that approach to try to, you know, not necessarily go super slow, but, you know, go carefully or go with a plan instead of just like, oh yeah, build me this software as a service. I'm just going to go and have a coffee break and then it will be done and then ship it to production.
You know who I think is the perfect person to do this sort of development who's not a developer? I think QA people would probably have really good results, right? Because imagine a person who does QA professionally, they usually know a little bit of programming, at least for like automation and things like that. And they are really good at spotting issues. So yeah. And also reporting them typically. So if you are a QA engineer, I would say try out agentic coding to make like a Mac app for you or something, because you already have the ability to report issues, find issues, and maybe even automate some stuff. So it just occurred to me. So if you're listening and you are a QA person and you've been using this stuff, let us know. I'm really curious. I think those types of people are the ones who can gain the most from the vibe coding train.
Right. All right. So I think we can wrap it up here for this 205th episode of Stack Trace. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. And if you do have any requests of topics you would like us to talk about on a future episode, make sure to ping us on either Mastodon, Blue Sky. Where are you these days, Rambo? Like, where what is your social media network of choice these days?
My social media of choice is Mastodon, mastodon.social@_inside. And we'll, of course, leave a link in the show notes.
Yes, absolutely. And I am John Sundell there and on Blue Sky as well, I think. We will leave links in the show notes for all of that stuff. But again, thanks so much for listening. And it's great to be back. We'll talk to you again next month. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.